Hey everyone, welcome into Patterns Tell Stories. I'm your host Klaus, and today we're going to be talking about the age of disclosure. With me today, as always, is my co-host Garrett. How's it going, man?
Really good, man. It's been a good week. How have you been?
I'm doing pretty well. Still living with these drones every day, pretty much. A lot less of them, but they're still kind of patrolling. So now it feels like I'm living in a surveillance state because nobody talks about it anymore. They've basically taken the whole thing out of the news. And obviously the news is distracted right now for a good reason. But yeah, the drones are still here. And it's interesting. I saw a few weeks ago this testimony that was posted on Reddit. It was for the Committee on Homeland Security. And the hearing was entitled Safeguarding the Homeland from Unmanned Aerial Systems. And this hearing happened on December 10th, 2024. So pretty recently. And they included an article containing testimony by Dr. Paul Schwinson, who is a environmental historian and military affairs analyst. He holds degrees in history and science from the U.S. Air Force Academy and served 10 years in the U.S. military in weapon systems acquisition. And he was presented with a medal by the Ukrainian Parliament for merit to the Ukrainian people. So he is an expert in the situation on the ground there when it comes to drone warfare, and his testimony is informed by that. And I'm just going to read this little section that was highlighted. It's going to raise some eyebrows. At least it did for me. So yeah, this is written testimony by Dr. Paul Schwinson. He basically goes through what he saw in Ukraine and the ability for the Ukrainians to adapt to battlefield conditions rather quickly and dynamically, and how our current military acquisitions process, really, there's too much red tape with it that would allow us to do the same thing that Ukraine is doing. And he's trying to raise the alarm on how vulnerable the U.S. is specifically against this threat. He lays out three scenarios that are possible and the DoD's response and what will happen going forward. And he says, it is easy to be a critic, but I am convinced that the United States and its NATO allies have a very narrow window of opportunity to address this major and growing shift in comparative advantage. Current operations in Ukraine have shown what a scrappy, innovative force can do to a large, hidebound military machine. It would be well to take note. And then he lists three scenarios that may happen in the future. He goes, least likely, the U.S. Department of Defense will quickly integrate UAS technology and training from Ukraine into its mainstream, operational-level frontline units. It would take an unprecedented level of commitment from all levels of the command structure and an extraordinary degree of political cooperation to shift the status quo. And he says, most likely, the U.S. will fall farther and farther behind the leading edge of UAS deployment and will only begin to respond in the aftermath of a crisis. My discussions with Capitol Hill legislators, frontline military leaders, defense analysts, and doctrine scholars lead invariably to the same independent conclusion. The American defense procurement system is too vast and the regulatory frameworks too inscrutable to meaningfully adopt UAS capabilities into existing defense doctrine or practice. An event akin to Pearl Harbor or 9/11 with the physical destruction of tens of billions of dollars of hardware and a substantial loss of life, will be required to jumpstart the innovation cycle and break down the thickets of red tape, which make initiative next to impossible. That's his main fear. And then, best case scenario. Conceivably, this kind of depressing scenario can be avoided through a well-managed artificial crisis. Historical examples, such as the famous sinking of the Ostfriesland, which I guess was a German ship that they captured and were running tests on, show that it is sometimes possible to break entrenched paradigms by publicly demonstrating the current system's vulnerabilities. When understood by the right audiences, these demonstrations can shift doctrine development and tactical training in new and constructive ways, preferably before lessons are learned the hard way. So that was December 10th in testimony before Homeland Security Committee.
Yeah. Whoa.
Can be avoided through a well-managed artificial crisis. He's specifically talking about drones. Pretty fascinating in the context of these drone incursions, right? That's
So the night of the 9th, Donald Trump said, nobody knows why. They don't want to talk about it. That could be us sending drones. I hope that's the case, us doing it and doing research. And maybe they don't want to talk about it from that standpoint. I hope it's not an enemy, but we're going to find out on the 21st.
We didn't.
The day after, the day after, you have to give me a little time with the inauguration, but shortly thereafter, we'll give you a report on it. We'll tell you exactly what it is. They know, and it's very strange that they aren't talking about it. And so fast forward to right now, it's the 23rd, and it still hasn't been disclosed.
And it's still happening.
Right. And the last time he was asked about it, he asked Susie Wiles, who's the White House chief of staff, to get back to him about it. But he hasn't spoken publicly about it again. And I'm really concerned that this is like not going to be dealt with or addressed and swept under the rug in a sense. And God, those scenarios were grim.
This definitely shot to the top of my list of possibilities of what these drones are. It's some sort of quasi false flag, scenario, artificial crisis, as this guy testified to. And how legal that is. I mean, the example he gave was the Osprey's Land sinking, which basically was when this General William Mitchell, who I guess is a pretty big deal when it comes to American air power, he was a decorated World War I air combat veteran. He basically came home to the United States after the war and was expected to be named chief of the air service. And it was given to someone else. And he really wanted to have a fully independent air force, which at the time Britain had with the Royal Air Force. So he was advocating for that. And yeah, the Navy was conducting tests. And basically, he ordered the bombing of these things, like trying to essentially demonstrate the importance of air power. And the Navy freaked out because they were not expecting that. And they had these tests planned in advance. And, I guess his point was proven, and then the Air Force was established. He was actually court-martialed for it in 1925. It was a super insubordinate move, and he was convicted and resigned his commission. But yeah, I guess that's kind of what the guy testifying before the Homeland Security Committee is suggesting, something like that, advocating for some sort of insubordination to do something drastic to change the current military paradigm based on, what he saw happening in Ukraine. And yeah, that sounds pretty similar to what might be happening with these drones. I found that interesting, and I think it's definitely something to keep in mind. And it sounds like Trump probably knew this from what you read.
Now I'm tempted to find the statement he made before that, where he was like very bold about it. His comment before was, the government knows what is happening. Our military knows where they took off from. If it's a garage, they can go right into that garage. They know where it came from and where it went. For some reason, they don't want to comment.
I guess if that is indeed the intent, is to demonstrate, we need to beef up our drone defenses or our policies that would give leeway to certain actions taking place on American soil. I don't know. In that same vein, it could also be a private contractor or tech company looking to gain from those new policies as well. So based on this testimony, and if what he's saying is reflective of the reality of what's happening here and apparently all over the world, it seems like this isn't officially sanctioned, to say the least. You don't really want to go out and say, hey, we have these insubordinate JSOC or whoever, special ops. If you take into consideration the stuff that was said by that dude who blew up the Tesla Cybertruck, you add what he said into this thing, it kind of says that's exactly what that is. There's a couple different reasons people would want to do that. There is the policy change aspect, and there are those who benefit from it. I mean, it's still going on, so it's clearly not something Trump has authority over unless he wants it to continue.
Yeah, I don't know, because it seems like, especially at the moment, he has the ability to galvanize an entire group of people towards publicly pressuring public figures into like doing what they want them to do. Like, it's really, I don't know, dude. I think that right now that guy could pretty much any topic he wanted to shed light on in terms of like being able to revoke people's clearances and like the amount of pressure that is put on somebody just from a couple times at a podium being like, I don't like this person. They're not a good American. They don't like you. I don't know. I feel like I'm talking crazy when I talk like that, though. I want to see what he does in a second term, but I'm just really concerned because just from right off the cuff, dude, saying that we're going to know by the 21st, I don't think we're going to know. There's so much classification and overclassification that this stuff is going to continue. It's not just like going to go away with just this one thing. More confusing shit is going to keep happening. And people are just going to like consistently be let down. It's demoralizing.
I don't know. Something to chew on for those wondering what the hell is going on with the drone situation and why everyone stopped talking about it. Yeah, still going on. Filmed one last night right over our apartment. So I don't know, man. It's freaky. I guess that is best case scenario for these drones as well, is that it's some way to prove that we need to up our defense capabilities. But there could also be ulterior motives for doing that. There's stuff that comes along with that that people could ride the coattails of financially or to get their foot in the door of defense contracts that they might not have gotten otherwise. But yeah, that's the update on the drones. I did want to see what you thought about this upcoming documentary from Dan Farah. A trailer was put out yesterday or the day before, and it features pretty much everyone that we know in the space who is sort of a big name in pushing for UFO disclosure. It seems really well done. The production value is insane, and it's going to be premiering at South by Southwest in March. So that's a pretty high-profile debut for a UFO documentary. And yeah, it's a Paramount Theater, apparently. I guess this has been in production for a while now. It's been hinted at by people like Lou for almost a couple of years. So this goes back, I don't know. I think I remember him talking to Jimmy Church about it a long time ago, where he's saying there's a UFO documentary coming out that is unlike any that you've seen before. Something like that, he said. And I believe this is it. And clearly has money behind it. The director, yeah, Dan Farah, is a legit film director. So it's pretty cool.
I wanted to also touch on the amount of government officials and elected representatives that are choosing to be in this movie. Like current office holders, Marco Rubio, Christian Gillibrand, Mike Rounds.
Clapper.
Yeah, Clapper.
Big deal.
Chris Mellon, Semi Van Galladay, Mike Gold from the UAP hearings.
So that's kind of where I guess Mike Gold came from. Everyone was kind of like, yeah, what's this random dude doing at the UAP hearing? And yeah, I'm sure he was in this movie and filmed his part before that hearing happened. So there you go.
How long has this movie been in the works?
I think a while. Years.
Like 5 years a while or like 10 years?
I would have to look at past comments from people. But yeah, definitely at least 2 years, I think.
Damn.
James Clapper is a big one that I think people were kind of expecting. He's a former CIA director, ODNI, huge top-level intelligence official for his whole life. Now he's an intelligence analyst for CNN. And when Lou did his thing, when I think he went on and talked about how the U.S. government has materials they recovered and stuff like that, Lou mentioned that Clapper came up and talked to him about the UFO thing and said he was glad that Lou was involved in, you know, ATIP. So that was a cool anecdote. And I guess it played out to where, yeah, James Clapper is now in a UFO documentary talking about, I guess, what he knows. It brings a lot of credibility to it. And it kind of raises the credibility of the people involved in the movie as a whole. But yeah, you mentioned Stratton. And he says in the trailer that he's seen non-human craft and non-human beings with his own eyes, which I guess isn't that surprising considering skinwalkers at the Pentagon and fucking dogmen in his backyard and orbs flying through his house and shit like that. But yeah, hearing him say it outright directly to the camera explicitly was pretty wild to hear, because he's been pretty quiet. And I guess we're going to be hearing more from him in the near future. And for those who don't know, Stratton was the, he set up the UAP task force in the government, and he was in the Navy, and yeah, excited to see what he has to say. His experiences are put forward in pretty intense detail in Skinwalkers at the Pentagon. He's, they codename him Axelrod. Yeah, his investigations at Skinwalker Ranch, apparently he got what is called the hitchhiker effect at the ranch and brought paranormal insanity back to his home. Maybe I can read a part of that real quick. So this is what they write. Most people who spend more than a day on Skinwalker Ranch brought, quote, something home with them from the property. The effect was almost universal and universally unpleasant. Even during the NIDS days, when Kelleher and Eric Davis spent literally hundreds of days on night watches on Skinwalker Ranch, their wives would occasionally remark waking up at night and seeing, quote, people in their bedrooms or black shadows walking through the house. These post-ranch events were noticeable, but mild, during the NIDS years. But they escalated dramatically with the Osset Bass program at the ranch in 2009. All five actively serving intelligence agency personnel who visited the ranch during the Osset Bass program experienced profound anomalies while on the property. And even more importantly, all five brought something home with them. Jonathan Axelrod, which is Jay Stratton, and his family are the, quote, poster children for the eruption of anomalies in the home following trips to Skinwalker Ranch. For more than a dozen years following his July 2009 and subsequent trips to the ranch, Axelrod's wife and then teenage children were subjected to nightmarish, quote, dogmen appearing in their backyard, to blue, red, yellow, and white orbs routinely floating through the home and in the yard, to black shadow people standing over their beds when they awoke, and to a relentless barrage of loud, unexplained footsteps walking up and down the stairs in their house. What was once a normal middle-class home in suburban Virginia became an inferno of bizarre, unexplained phenomena. And Axelrod and his family were certain that the trigger for this transformation was his first trip to Skinwalker Ranch. It is indeed lucky that the Axelrod family was, and is, extremely stable, psychologically well-adjusted, and grounded and prone to matter-of-fact reactions to these events. The Axelrod family also suffered health effects, with the wife suffering flare-ups of lupus and Raynaud's disease. Both Axelrod teenagers also suffered intense flu-like symptoms at different times following anomalies in their home, with the most serious medical symptoms occurring in the younger teenager after being attacked on the night of February 7, 2011, by blue and red orbs in his bedroom. The Axelrod teenagers endured some very scary episodes in their bedrooms and were wise enough to keep quiet about them among their circle of friends. Imagine Paul Axelrod's shock when he was approached by one of his high school friends in 2011, who told him that on the previous night, he had looked out his bedroom window and had witnessed a large wolf-like creature standing outside his bedroom looking in at him. A few weeks later, another friend told Paul, seeing strange blue lights flying around his backyard. These revelations by the two friends came without prompting from Paul. In other words, they cannot be dismissed as Me Too phenomena. So yeah, that's kind of a rundown of what Jay Stratton and his family experienced from what is known as the hitchhiker effect. I'm assuming some of that will be detailed from his personal experience in that movie that's coming out, The Age of Disclosure. I'm not sure if that's what he means specifically by I've seen non-human beings in craft, like the orbs and the wolf thing, but maybe there's more he experienced within his time in the government, which I'm sure he has, but it's pretty fascinating and scary as fuck.
I had a thing about the Axelrods in a Colm Kelleher article. Like a lot of what you were reading, it seemed like was verbatim out of it from this article, was from the book, but there's a part where he's talking about infectious agents. I just wanted to read this little paragraph real quick. He says, during 2020 and 2021, everyone in the world became familiar with the jargon of coronavirus infectious disease modeling. After thousands of newspaper, TV, and digital media reports detailed the first COVID-19 index cases in Washington State, Wuhan, California, and New York, the concept of an index case for an infectious disease became familiar to everyone. Just as the Wuhan Institute of Virology or the wet markets in China, may have been the source of the COVID-19 outbreak. Could Skinwalker Ranch be the source of an infectious agent of some kind? The experiences of Axelrod and others have led me to consider an infectious disease model to try to shed some light on the phenomena, as they bore a striking resemblance to the transmission of an infectious agent between individuals. The, quote, symptoms of the, quote, infection compromise the eruption of poltergeists and other paranormal events in the immediate environment of the newly infected individual. Utilizing this terminology, Axelrod was the index case who was first infected on Skinwalker Ranch and carried the infectious agent 2,000 miles home to Virginia with him. Within a few days or weeks, the agent had spread from Axelrod to his wife and both his teenage sons, and all three began experiencing a bewildering diversity of anomalies in their home. Within a few more weeks, the infectious agent had spread to the neighborhood and infected two teenage friends, probably at school, who lived within a couple of miles from the Axelrod home. It should be noted that the symptoms of infection from Skinwalker Ranch are not respiratory distress or death, as with COVID-19, but rather profoundly altered perceptual environments. So that's all I wanted to say about that, because I thought that was worth reading.
So that's Axelrod, also known as Jay Stratton. Yeah, looking forward to hearing from him. On the same note as OSAP and those guys, there was a new interview released today where it was a talk with Peter Skafish of the Soul Foundation. They had this back in November, and they're just releasing these interviews now. He interviewed Dr. Eric Davis, who, you know, many in the UFO field know as someone who worked for NIDS, for Robert Bigelow, and investigations at Skinwalker Ranch. He brought the knowledge he gained from NIDS and his investigation tactics to the Air Force Research Laboratory. And the other person in this interview was Kirk McConnell, who up until very recently, I think just last year, he was a longtime staffer for the Senate Armed Services Committee and Senate Intelligence Committee. So he was there to receive a briefing from Eric Davis. I believe that's kind of where he first got into it. Eric Davis's testimony and findings were very informative for Kirk McConnell's investigations into UAP with those committees. So it was cool to see them together talking about that and going back and forth on what they were doing at the time. And Eric Davis sort of gave his background in what he was investigating and what was going on when he was working for the government. And it really completely lines up with what's mentioned in the famous Wilson Davis notes, where it basically is meeting notes that he jotted down after a meeting with Admiral Tom Wilson, who I believe was director of DIA or something. I don't know if you want to get his biography up, but
he was a vice admiral and a director of the Defense Intelligence Agency and the director of intelligence for the U.S. Atlantic Command. He was the Director of National Intelligence from July 27th, 1999 to July 2002, which he was. So that means during 9/11, he was the Director of National Intelligence.
Wow. Yeah. And he told Eric Davis about how he was getting shut out of these programs. He was the top guy and he didn't even have access. And he was basically getting shit on for knocking on doors and trying to figure out what was going on with UFOs. He was a top level guy. And to this day, he denies that stuff ever happened. But as many people correctly point out, he has to do that due to his security clearance. So hearing Eric Davis sort of detail his history, I found interesting in the context of those notes and that meeting with Admiral Wilson that he had. Yeah, I think he took at least part of what he learned from Wilson and gave testimony to Kirk McConnell and others on the SASC, including senators. He basically went and became a principal investigator for the Air Force Research Laboratory, did research on, you know, advanced propulsion, all the sort of stuff that was UAP related. He's been working on this stuff for decades within the government. He was essentially tasked by one of his program managers at the Air Force Research Lab to find out as much as he could about secret UFO programs, which is kind of crazy that people at the AFRL would not be privy to that stuff. I guess if Tom Wilson isn't, anyone underneath him isn't either. So I guess it's not that surprising. But Davis worked for the AFRL Advanced Concepts Office. In his research, he found out a lot of interesting shit. A lot that he can't talk about. But he says, the accumulated weight of the evidence given to me firsthand by people who worked or were briefed or were exposed to these programs was irrefutable. It was very difficult to dismiss, and it literally took it from myth of the published UFO literature at the time as being a form of mythology to being to the level that there's a there. So my evidence from confronting all these people in classified and in proprietary corporate environments is that there is a there. It is not a mythology. It's not just based on a shred of truth. It's based on breadcrumbs, partial loaves of bread, and entire loaves of bread. If this program is real, and I spoke to senior VPs who actually worked on the crash retrieval program, as well as the executive administration assistants who were in charge of security, security officers, and it goes on and on. I developed a lot of this during my work at NIDS and AFRL and working for many years with Hal Puthoff. He was actually deputized by James Lukatsky to go look for these programs. He gave a list of presidents who were briefed on the topic, on the program specifically, and he said that the initial legacy program was due to a signed presidential emergency action document signed by Eisenhower in the 1950s. They're called PEADs, P-E-A-D.
What is that now, by Eisenhower?
It's a presidential emergency action document that was classified. So it's sort of an executive order, I guess, but more secret. This is what keeps the waived unacknowledged special access programs, the UAP crash retrieval programs, outside of congressional oversight. The classified PEADs are designed to implement extraordinary presidential authority in response to extraordinary situations, such that they are not even subjected to congressional oversight, and there is no requirement to disclose the PEADs to Congress, and they've never been disclosed to Congress. Yeah, and then he goes on to say the presidents that were briefed: Eisenhower, Kennedy, Nixon, Carter, Reagan, and the Bushes. And he says Bill Clinton was not briefed and that his cabinet secretaries lied to him about it, which is interesting.
What the hell?
Yep. He also said the physics, engineering, and manufacturing is not there. Material science capabilities have been bolstered by UAP reverse engineering, but that's about it. And he mentions programmed quantum materials, which kind of sounds like what the materials are that these crafts possess. And then he mentioned a story about Lukatsky that he wrote in this book. Lukatsky was the program manager of OSAP. Yeah, he mentioned the intact UFO. Lukatsky was able to enter and saw no visible propulsion system. Those are kind of the highlights. There's probably more I missed, but yeah, thought it was interesting. He laid out which presidents were briefed. I mean, based on his research and the investigations he conducted for the Air Force and other private companies.
That's wicked.
Yeah.
I'd like to know about all those guys, how much they knew. Nixon, I want to know about. Yeah.
And Nixon, I guess, is the one who put it in private industry, is the general consensus, I think.
I wonder how diverse of a term that is, saying that someone worked in advanced propulsion. Because that could mean all sorts of stuff, right? Couldn't you be a physicist, or couldn't you like be a pilot, or couldn't you? I'm not saying that he was, but
he says he was the principal investigator for the Air Force Research Laboratory's Advanced Concepts Office.
That's so sick.
It's kind of like an intel guy too. I remember he said the UFO phenomenon issue is a intelligence issue, not a scientific issue, which I found interesting. And the fact that he was basically doing intelligence gathering, right? That's kind of what it sounds like. But he's also obviously a brilliant scientist. It's kind of a unique mix of things. And the fact that he has photographic memory, or whatever that's called, I think Gary Nolan alluded to, he's a savant where he remembers everything. So that's why his notes were so complete. What is that called? Yeah, it's called hyperthymesia, or highly superior autobiographical memory, is a condition that leads people to be able to remember an abnormally large amount of their life experiences in vivid detail. It is extraordinarily rare, with fewer than 100 people in the world having been diagnosed with this condition as of 2021. So yeah, it's pretty rare. I'd say 100 people in the world. That's why his notes, the Wilson Davis notes, were so thorough. I think it was John Greenwald who said it was a movie script. It was so detailed, it sounded ridiculous. But it's like, no, this guy literally remembers everything. You can hear it too when he tells his stories. He'll basically lays out every detail and is extremely confident about what happened and when it happened. And he'll give dates, and it's wild. So and he'll say it just like off the top of his head. So yeah, you definitely want someone like that looking into where these UFO programs are if you're trying to find out if this technology exists within the government and, you know, it's being hidden from the friggin' Air Force Research Lab. It's a good guy to have on your team.
And Eric Davis, doesn't he co-own Earth Tech or something with Hal Puthoff? I don't know if he owns part of it, but
I don't think so.
Sure, they do research together.
Yeah, he's worked there. He's been the chief scientist, I think. He says it in the interview.
Okay, yeah, on Earth Tech's site, it says he's a senior science advisor.
Yeah.
And he and Hal Puthoff wrote a paper together called Extracting Energy from the Quantum Vacuum.
That's why he's talking about programmable quantum materials. It really sounds like the material science aspect of this, they were able to exploit it, but you know, everything else has been, they have no idea what to do with. Why do you think Bill Clinton wasn't briefed? Blowjobs?
No, dude, because like we've heard before, these guys are thought of as temporary employees. They're not the lifers.
But why were the other presidents briefed? What's the difference there? I'm trying to make a, I'm trying to figure out what the difference is between those presidents and the ones who weren't briefed.
Well, Clinton beat Bush Sr. and Bush Sr. never got to serve a second term, which was something significant about his son winning in 2004 against John Kerry, was that he did what his father couldn't, is that he got his second term. So there was probably some sort of spite there. And keep in mind, Bush was Reagan's vice president. So they had just had two terms of Reagan and a Bush term. So it was 12 years of Republican era. And who was before Reagan? Jimmy Carter?
Yeah, he was briefed, apparently.
So if Reagan took over and then Bush was his like right-hand man, was all entrenched in the intelligence community, I think Bush Sr. was a former CIA director. And that the CIA center or headquarters is named after him. So if Clinton won, it probably kind of turned the wagon cart over.
That's a good point. Hillary Clinton's interests and Podesta meeting with Tom DeLonge and all that stuff. It was actually kind of funny. I found a tweet from Julian Assange about the 2017 New York Times article. That's interesting, too, because in those Podesta leaks that WikiLeaks did, was a copy of the PDF of Secret Machines Chasing Shadows. You kind of wonder, like, with all the intelligence plot lines and stuff in that book. Let me read this tweet real quick from Julian Assange. He puts a screenshot of it and highlights Hal Puthoff. And he says, the New York Times fake news apocalypse has reached perfection with a front page story claiming UFOs exist. No surprise to see CIA parapsychology Scientology frauds like Harold E. Puthoff involved in the most basic journalistic questions unasked. There has long been a battle for the UFO vote, hence the apparent involvement of former Democratic Senator Harry Reid. Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign explicitly pandered to it. I don't know, it sounds like Stephen Greenstreet, honestly.
Who was the chief of staff for Bill Clinton? Wasn't it Sandy Berger? Was that his name? Sandy Berger was a Democratic attorney who served as the 18th National Security Advisor for Bill Clinton from 1997 to 2001, and he had served as the Deputy National Security Advisor for the Clinton administration from 93 to 97. So he, according to Bill Clinton, he asked Sandy Berger to figure out what was going on with UFOs. And when he tried to dig in deeper, he said that they were stonewalled.
Eric Davis says that Bill Clinton's cabinet lied about it. I'm guessing that was him. If someone lied to Bill Clinton about it, it was Sandy Bob's Burgers.
Hold on. I'm pulling it up. So he said John Podesta's chief of staff was a big sci-fi fan. And he said jokingly, and that he wanted to get down to the bottom of what happened at Roswell. And then Clinton says he sent people down to Area 51. And then when James Corden goes, well, who did you send? He jokes. He's like, I can't tell you. And then he breaks. He's like, okay, I sent Sandy Berger, who is my national security advisor. He says it gets complicated by Area 51 because that's where they do their invisibility research, is what Bill Clinton called it, which is an interesting way to term it or phrase it, is that's where they do their invisibility research. And he clarifies, and he's about how we have to have planes that can't get picked up by radar, implying stealth technology. But I don't know. There's a lot there to unpack. Yeah, it kind of is the connecting fiber between John Podesta and Sandy Berger and their interest in this overall. But I don't think he said much else besides that.
In 1999, Berger was criticized for failing to promptly inform President Clinton of his knowledge that the People's Republic of China had managed to acquire the designs of a number of U.S. nuclear warheads. Berger was originally briefed of the espionage by the Department of Energy in April 1996, but did not inform the president until July 1997. On July 19, 2004, it was revealed that the United States Department of Justice was investigating Berger for unauthorized removal of classified documents in October 2003 from a National Archives reading room prior to testifying before the 9/11 Commission. The documents were five classified copies of a single report commissioned from Richard Clark, covering internal assessments of the Clinton administration's handling of the unsuccessful 2000 Millennium attack plots. He was disbarred. After leaving the Clinton administration, Berger became chairman of Stonebridge International, an international advisory firm he co-founded in 2001, which focused on aiding companies in their expansion into emerging markets such as Brazil, China, India, and Russia.
Oh my God. This guy's a dirtbag.
Yeah, that's something else.
What a scumbag.
Yeah.
Fuck Sandy Berger, dude. So that's probably why Clinton wasn't briefed.
I would assume so. It says, after leaving the State Department, Berger went on to join the law firm Hogan & Hartson. Sandy Berger, Nancy Pelosi said in 1997, was the point man at Hogan & Hartson for the trade office of the Chinese government. He was a lawyer lobbyist. Cool. Anyway.
The last thing it says on his Wikipedia, it says in 2000, Berger was presented with an honorary degree from Tel Aviv University in Israel.
Nice.
Why would he get an honorary degree for, I don't know. They give those out to a bunch of people, though. Bill Cosby had an honorary degree. I was like, but I mean, it was before. I shouldn't have used him as an example because he had his shit revoked, I'm pretty sure.
From where? Like Penn State?
No Frills delivers. Get groceries delivered to your door from No Frills with PC Express. Shop online and get $15 in PC Optimum points on your first five orders. Shop now at nofrills.ca.
That was bad. Sorry.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Dude, so
Bill Cosby had 72. I don't want to go into a Bill Cosby segue, but Bill Cosby had 72 honorary degrees, bro. And 62 have been revoked. 10 of them have.
I was going to say, 10 of them. Read those. Who did it?
Yeah, those are the ones we need to read. All right.
What was the Von Braun thing?
So this is what I found on the CIA site when I was looking through like for Von Braun stuff. And if you read on there, it says headline, Wernher von Braun warns and advanced propulsion concepts project outgrowth. But it doesn't say project correct. It says project. So it's like a typo. But I was
up, CIA.
So it seemed like it was just like a collect because they're in the Tom DeLonge said, dude, they have the access to the same books we do. And like it's they're in the business of collecting information and intelligence. Right. So whatever this headline was something that they felt was worth keeping tabs on. And then I Googled Project Outgrowth, and the Black Vault website, John Greenwald's site, came up. And on the Black Vault site, the thing that pops up is this document, and it says unclassified/limited Defense Technical Information Center. And when I looked up what the Defense Technical Information Center was, it said the DTIC is a Department of Defense field activity that provides access to scientific, research, and engineering information for the U.S. military and government agencies. DTIC serves as a central repository for the collection, storage, retrieval, and dissemination of defense-related technical information regarding research reports, technical documents, and other scientific data.
That shit's going to be shut down in, within a week.
So this is the document that comes up after that header. It says Foreign Technology Division, and the insignia at the top says Air Force Systems Command. And when I looked up what that is, the Air Force Systems Command Foreign Technology Division was a specialized unit within the United States Air Force tasked with analyzing and understanding foreign military technologies, particularly those related to aviation. It officially became the Foreign Technology Division in 1961 under the Air Force Systems Command. The FTD's primary mission was to study captured or acquired foreign military hardware, such as aircraft, missiles, and electronics, to uncover their design, engineering, materials, propulsion systems, and operational capabilities. This information was crucial for U.S. military intelligence, helping to predict adversary capabilities and inform U.S. technological development. For context, it says, historically, much of this work was conducted at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio, where NASIC is now located. This division played a pivotal role in the U.S. Air Force's ability to maintain technological dominance by understanding and adapting to foreign advancements. So that makes sense if it's related to Von Braun, at least based on what I understand. Because if you believe Edgar Mitchell, when Edgar Mitchell went on Coast to Coast, I think it was with George Norrie, he gave a few long form interviews before he died. And he goes into detail about Roswell. And he said that Wernher von Braun was one of the people that the government called upon to investigate Roswell. Mitchell says that in an interview. I think that's something that gets glossed over pretty easily. George Norrie says, and so you are convinced that he, talking about Wernher von Braun, believed that we have been visited? And Edgar Mitchell replies, yeah, no question. That was his belief. Now, that doesn't mean that he went around talking about it all the time, but he was apparently there and asked to investigate that first incident because of his rocketry knowledge, referring to Roswell.
Doesn't he write in that thing about how Earth is a spaceship or something like
yes,
that?
Yes, yes. So in the article, it says, Wernher von Braun warns, by author unknown, country of origin, West Germany, and the source is, it seems like a German magazine called UFO Nachrichte. UFO Nachrichte.
Is that how the Germans pronounce UFO?
No. UFO. UFO Nachrichte. And it says, Dr. Von Braun, a leading personality in the Apollo moon landing program, said, we must look upon Earth as a solitary spaceship with an unknown destiny, upon which 3.5 billion astronauts are traveling through space. These astronauts are misusing the strictly limited raw materials of the spaceship Earth. It is absolutely essential that immediate and decisive steps be taken against this. What the world must do is to promote a better understanding of the situation and to demand precise planning. Satellites must be used to obtain reliable data on Earth's minerals and food sources, on the growth of cities, and the state of the population. When this information is fed into a computer, we then will be able to prevent famine before it strikes a nation. Dr. Von Braun said that satellites can also serve to educate the people of overpopulated countries to undertake family planning. This would be done by televising programs to them. Other scientists agree with Dr. von Braun that the situation is critical. Kenneth Gatland, the vice president of the British Interplanetary Society, said, "Our only salvation will be the broadest application of science, including satellites and technology. We are space travelers and must concern ourselves with the spaceship. We must not exploit its mineral capacity in a happy-go-lucky manner." Gatland also sees help in the satellites. He said that the first Earth Resources Technology satellite, which was launched this summer, can forecast harvests, vegetation, disease, vital land area information, and air and water pollution. He added, "Satellites can also discover such things as locust swarms, oil spills, hurricanes, and forest fires." Valentin Cleaver, the rocket director of Britain's Rolls-Royce, said, "The pressing problems of our civilization will become worse as the natural resources of the world are exhausted. The best way to bring a halt to this condition is surveillance by means of satellite."
Yeah, you know who I want advice on family planning from? A fucking Nazi.
Jesus Christ. Isn't it concerning when a former Nazi major says that the world has too many people on it and that people are using its resources a little too much? Like, that is psycho shit.
Yeah.
Hey, that's who supposedly his uncorroborated deathbed warning is what we need to listen to, bro. Haven't you read the comments?
Yep.
He beamed it into Carol Rosen's brain, man.
Satellites.
I mean, I don't even know. I don't even know what he used. Maybe.
On that note, so on the topic of the planet going to hell, I wanted to read this report that was published by Risk Frontiers. They are a risk assessment and management consultant agency. I believe they're based in Australia. They essentially do reports for insurance companies and governments and, you know, those kinds of organizations on risks of certain catastrophes happening. They provide software with models that simulate different scenarios for major disasters and that kind of thing. And that helps these companies plan accordingly. So one of the things on their website that they publish, I had read, I don't know, probably a couple of years ago, and it's titled "The Risks of Weakening of the Earth's Magnetic Field." And just knowing that they wrote this in the context of the insurance industry is kind of freaky. It's written by Paul Somerville, who is an engineering seismologist at AECOM, chief geoscientist at Risk Frontiers. They're located within a university, Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia. And he applies physics-based modeling methods to understanding the influence of earthquakes and seismic wave propagation. So he wrote this little essay, I guess I'll call it, about the risks that need to be taken into account by corporations and governments when it comes to the Earth's magnetic field. "The Earth's magnetic field protects life from cosmic rays, energetic particles that would otherwise arrive from space. Mars now lacks a strong magnetic field, and the conditions on its surface are thought to be so damaging to life that any microbes that might inhabit the planet are thought to live safely beneath the surface. On Earth, the magnetic field ensures that life can flourish on the surface. However, as Earth's magnetic field weakens, its satellites start to fail. First, our communication satellites in the highest orbits go down. Next, astronauts in low Earth orbit can no longer phone home. Eventually, cosmic rays start to bombard every living thing on Earth. This is an eventuality that we are facing now and in the next few hundred years. If Earth's magnetic field were to decay significantly, it could collapse altogether and reverse polarity from magnetic north. The consequences of this process could be dire for our planet, even if it does not lead to reversal. The strength of the geomagnetic field has been decaying for the last 3,000 years, and at the current rate of decay, it may be at a critically low level within 1,000 years. The Earth's magnetic field is predominantly created by the flow of liquid iron inside the core. It has always been a feature of our planet, but it has reversed polarity repeatedly through Earth's history. Each time it reverses, up to 100 times in the past 20 million years, with the reversal taking about 1,000 years to complete. It leaves fossilized magnetization in rocks and sediments on Earth that can be discovered by carbon dating of the mud and cores of sediments from the seafloor, and most recently, the fibers of dead kauri trees that have been preserved in swamps. For a polarity reversal to occur, the magnetic field needs to weaken by about 90% to a threshold level. As it weakens, the lack of a protective magnetic shield around our planet allows more cosmic rays, high-energy particles from elsewhere in the universe, to generate cosmogenic isotopes such as carbon-14, whose radioactive decay rate can show when polarity reversals took place. The last major reversal occurred between 772,000 and 774,000 years ago. Since then, the field has almost reversed 15 times, dropping in strength significantly in an excursion, but not quite reaching the threshold needed to reverse before rising again. This is when we are most at risk, as the field decays and then recovers its strength. The last excursion occurred 42,000 years ago in an event named the LeChamp excursion, in which the poles briefly reverse, and evidence suggests we are heading for a weakening and possible reversal again. The LeChamp excursion, we talked about this in a previous episode. The precise chronology of the LeChamp's excursion has now been derived by linking two data sets. Firstly, measurements of the Earth's magnetic field from sediment cores of the Black Sea were matched with Greenland ice cores via climate variation documented at the same time. Secondly, the precise analysis and dating of the events was made possible by the radiocarbon analysis of a subfossil kauri tree. Not only did the magnetic field reverse polarity 42,000 years ago, it first dramatically lost strength. The kauri tree ring record indicated that the magnetic field began to drop at 42,350 years ago and reached its lowest level 41,800 years ago, 300 years before the actual temporary pole reversal. The magnetic North Pole moved south over a period of about 500 years as the magnetic field weakened to about 6% of its normal value. Over a period of about 500 years, the poles remained temporarily reversed, with a field strength that varied below 28% of today's value, only to reverse back again over the course of about 250 years. Because the time flip was centered on 42 kiloyears, the researchers decided to name this the Adams Transitional Geomagnetic Event, after author Douglas Adams. There has been much speculation that the weakened magnetic field during the Adams event may be associated with changes in climate, faunal extinctions, including that of the Neanderthals, and the migration of humans from Central Asia to Europe. Australia saw a major extinction event of its megafauna that peaked at roughly 42,000 years ago, suggestive of a link to the altered rainfall that the Adams event seems to have triggered in the Southern Hemisphere. The geomagnetic field has lost 30% of its intensity over the last 3,000 years and is predicted to drop to near zero over the next several centuries. Already, we can see the effects of a weakened magnetic field on satellites in orbit. In the Atlantic Ocean between South America and Africa, there is a vast region of Earth's magnetic field called the South Atlantic Anomaly that is about three times weaker than the field strength at the poles. This is a region where satellites consistently experience electronic failures. The SAA was first noticed in the 1950s, and since then it has decreased in strength by a further 6% and has moved to the west. Scientists are investigating what is going on inside Earth's core that might be causing the SAA. One possibility is that there could be a vast convection in the southern portion of Earth's liquid metal outer core that may be pushing the magnetic field out from the South Atlantic region. Another possibility is that a mini-polarity reversal is taking place in this region. The SAA may be portending what is to come in the near future. If trends continue, the planet's magnetic field could reverse once again in one or two millennia. Even if it does not, the field may continue to weaken, and within a century, we could be faced with serious problems. The decrease in geomagnetic field strength is much more important and dramatic than the reversal, and it is critical to understand whether the present field will decay to zero in the next century, because if it does, we will need to prepare. For the first time, astronomers have detected a powerful 1,000-kilometer-wide hurricane of plasma, which is electrically charged gas, in Earth's upper atmosphere. The, quote, space hurricane raged for nearly 8 hours on August 20th, 2014, swirling hundreds of miles above Earth's magnetic North Pole. Formed by the interaction of magnetic field lines and the solar wind, the hurricane was invisible to the naked eye, but four weather satellites that passed over the North Pole detected a formation analogous to a terrestrial hurricane. The space hurricane was shaped like a funnel, with a quiet, quote, eye in the center, surrounded by several counterclockwise spinning spiral arms of plasma. The space hurricane rained electrons directly into Earth's upper atmosphere. Until now, it was uncertain that space plasma hurricanes existed. Tropical storms are associated with huge amounts of energy, and the space hurricane was evidently created by unusually large and rapid transfer of solar wind energy and charged particles into Earth's upper atmosphere. While this is the first observed space hurricane, they may be common events. They have the potential to impact known space weather effects, such as increasing drag on satellites or disrupting GPS and radio communication systems. By altering the orbits of space junk objects, they could pose potentially serious hazards to orbiting space stations. That's it. Nothing to worry about.
All the magnetic shit freaks me out, man.
Magnets, bitch. Yeah, it's a pretty sobering analysis of the risk associated with the status of our Earth's magnetic field. So clearly the companies that, you know, this risk assessment firm is consulting for have this in their models. This guy does not pull any punches when it comes to communicating the seriousness of what we're dealing with. It's kind of crazy that nobody's talking about it. I guess not really, because all the rich people have their bunkers and shit, so kind of makes sense. But I think it's really notable that someone who makes their money off assessing risks is saying that this is what people need to be paying attention to. Yeah, space hurricane shit is crazy. Makes me wonder about those plasma proto-life forms that we talked about a few weeks ago. And then it also plays into the idea of the cycle of civilizations. I mean, this clearly has happened a lot in the past. Yeah, then you have explosions of cave art. I don't know, did humans or Neanderthals, or did they just live in caves while there's cosmic rays pouring down onto the Earth from having no magnetic field? Like, did we become subterranean? I don't know. These timelines are really long.
I'm gonna grab a book off my shelf real quick, that Travis Taylor book he wrote, because it involves like solar flares and like I think there's a little excerpt in that book where he talks about this specifically. I'm going to try to find it real quick.
Check it out.
Okay. So this is from Travis S. Taylor, who I believe is the head scientist at Skinwalker Ranch, or at least was. And he's a physicist from Alabama, I believe. And he's been contracted by the Department of Defense for years to research all sorts of advanced applications of like rocketry. He's like a classic rocket scientist geek, but he writes sci-fi books, and I picked up one of his sci-fi books, and I might have read it before on this show, and it's called Saving Proxima. The first step to the stars is a fight for survival. And in this book, there's a discussion where scientists on Earth are discussing what these different glyphs mean on the walls. And one of the scientists is convinced that they are starting to suspect that there were other civilizations, like advanced civilizations. And they think that they figured out what the glyphs meant. And then another scientist like starts bringing in the cosmic ray aspect to all this. And I thought it was really interesting. The remains we found, they are all human. Since the atmosphere here is remarkably similar to Earth's, uncannily so in its composition, we measured the interactions of incoming cosmic rays with the atoms in Proxima B's upper atmosphere and found the rate at which carbon-14 is produced, normalized it with what we are used to on Earth, and then applied the results to dating the remains we found in the burial mounds. They carbon-14 date to over 51,000 years ago, and the stories left on the walls of the inside of this temple appear to be telling us of an ancient, much more advanced culture than even what we have on Earth today, perhaps having developed here tens of thousands of years ahead of us. This sounds like an Atlantis-type myth, Alma Jones briefed the rest of the Proxima 1 base team. The myth that is recorded, though, is much darker than ours. This advanced culture here just vanished. There were two different interpretations that Dr. Oliveira Santos and I came up with after the AI cracked the glyphs. One, they left the planet. Two, they died and their spirits went to heaven. Typical kind of ancient myth debate here. Alma paused and looked to the linguist. Maggie? What we have here is a tale of two cities all over again. No matter which interpretation we use here, Dr. Maggie Oliveira Santos explained as her face popped up on the main screen at half court, there appears to be haves and have-nots. Whoever this Atlantis culture, as Alma calls them, were, they were somehow different and more advanced than the others, and it appears they must have mixed their genetic line with the lesser advanced culture for centuries, maybe millennia. For whatever reason, their advanced culture or technologies weren't shared. Maybe they were like the Romans and the rest of the world were slaves or at least labor peasants in an extreme lower class. The story told by the glyphs isn't clear on this. This is where it gets interesting, Alma whispered to Charles sitting beside her at the table sitting in front of the bleachers. You mean it wasn't already? He shot back at her quietly. Then the Atlanteans, again, what Alma calls them as we never found a name, started dying at an extremely fast pace. There must have been some disease then, because the glyphs show them falling dead in rows. It was a very significant time for them, and there were these glyphs here representing this. Maggie tossed an image of the wall inside the temple onto the main screen so everyone could view it, and then she continued. You see here how there are rows of people with these ornate-looking belts and bandoliers? That is how they drew the advanced people. The normal people are always stick figures. Well, look at this image here and see how the stick figures are smaller and prostrate to the others. Now how the sun behind them is illuminating them with these rays. Now, what appears to be later in the story, we see the same type of presentation, but the sun is much larger and more pronounced, and there are rays coming all over the way to the taller, advanced people's figures. Now, what appears to be later in the story, we see this same type of presentation, but the sun is much larger and more pronounced, and there are rays coming all the way to the taller, advanced people's figures. Maybe this means they were more godlike or in touch with the heavens. We're not sure about that. But it is here where we see Maggie change the image to this one Alma found. You see here that the larger figures with the ornate belts and such, well, some are standing and some are horizontal. Perhaps these rays from the sun are representative of their spirits going to the heavens when they died. Maybe they were sun worshippers. Alma started to flip to the next screen, but was interrupted. Dr. Gilster was standing up, waving at her. Hold on a minute, Rain said. Her face appeared on the screen. The little conference drone silently hovered closer to her. No offense, Alma, Maggie, but that isn't what the glyph is telling us at all. No offense taken. Go on, Rain. Alma sat back down. Proxima Centauri is known to be a highly active flare star. We just haven't seen it flare in a while. The flares act a lot like solar flares due to energy stored in the star's extreme magnetic field. The field lines within the star get very strong and warped out of shape due to other magnetic field lines. When there is enough of a tug on one of the lines, it breaks and reconnects to a nearby line. When this happens, there is an enormous amount of energy released. In fact, the star's brightness will increase all across the spectrum, from radio up to X-rays. Solar winds are accelerated to significant portions of the speed of light. Those X-rays and accelerated ions are then slammed into the planets within the solar system. This is why we weren't sure at first that Proxima B could actually house life, because if the planet didn't have a strong magnetic field, which we now know it does, these flares would irradiate and kill anything over time. However, the strong magnetic field of the planet helps shield them from this. What are you suggesting, Rain? Maggie asked before the screen could change. I'm suggesting that whoever these advanced people were, their bodies were being killed by the solar flares. The pictures don't give you a time epoch. They could have been dying of cancer from the exposure. Maybe skin cancer or something. Rain sat back down. Holy. Rain, you've just explained why this next part occurred. Alma stood up. You see, we hadn't finished the story. It was at this point, when the Atlanteans started dying off, that the peasant cultures started an ethnic cleansing. Alma tossed an icon about and then threw something at the screen. This set of glyphs here shows a family tree of sorts. Any of the lower culture that had heritage back upward through their bloodlines with any of the Atlanteans were purged. There was a major upheaval and a war here. This entire continent was divided racially, or I guess ancestrally, and hundreds of millions fought and died. The non-Atlantean line won and marched the rest into what must have been death camps that would have made what the Nazis did pale in comparison. They thought it was a contagious disease killing them? Charles asked. They must have. So, out of fear and ignorance, they started removing the cancer from their planet. Alma replied. This makes perfect sense now. Before, we just assumed it was some disease. Now with this, we know that at first, well, it was a disease, but it wasn't contagious. Over time, had they not overreacted, then the solar flares would have killed off those susceptible and the stronger ones would have survived. Selective adaptation would have occurred given time to do so, but they didn't let it. They forced it and went overboard with it, Maggie agreed, and they cleansed their planet of whatever races were due to the intermingling of these people with their own. Wait, has anyone done an assessment of the number of races within the Fintidarians? Charles asked. We haven't really. Yoko Pearl stood and gave the drone time to zoom in on her. Early on, before we left Earth, we did go through as much of their video as we could to look for diversity in the genetic pool. We concluded that we didn't have a good enough sampling across their culture to know for certain. We base this on looking at our motives of that era of technology. The genetic makeup of the planet was very poorly represented at the time. At least that was our conclusion. I'll agree with that. Dr. Rahim Ramachandra said, I'm aware of this effort, and we concluded in parallel from a study of our own archived data that an accurate model of the genetic makeup of the era couldn't be accomplished. All right, then. Charles held up a hand to quiet everyone down. Everyone, I think we are close to an answer here, and it is time I brief you on something that the President of the United States briefed me on just before we left. Commander Rogers, are we certain we are clear of Fintidarians here? Yes, sir. There's no presence of them as of yet. We are expecting a food and supplies vessel at 15:30, but we're clear. Commander Mike Rogers replied, and we're certain they are not eavesdropping on us somehow. Vic, Rogers turned the screen over to his intel specialist. Mr. Ambassador, there's no technology that these people have that we cannot detect. There were listening devices in various locations that might have been placed in malice or just as internal communications during construction that were left behind. But they all have been deactivated. We are clear to speak here, Tarasenko assured him. All right, then. This is never revealed to the Fintidarians and is considered to be classified to Earthlings only. I need all of you to raise your right hand and swear to this. If you can't do that, I'll ask you to leave the room and the channel for a bit. Charles waited, and nobody left the room or cleared the channel. Then he opened up a file and had an oath displayed on the screen and sent to all of the Earthlings. Raise your right hands. Read the oath out loud, please. The AIs will record it for the record. Charles waited until his AI showed that all of them had read the oath and digitally signed it. Very well. Before we left, I was briefed by Dr. Jason Fahim, an expert in pandemic and population studies. What he told me was that there are actually three locations on planet Earth to date that have for generations shown a tremendous gender discrepancy in their population census data. Charles paused and then ticked them off on his fingers. Those are 1, Saudi Arabia, 2, Oman, and 3, a small area in Asia known as Bhutan. Dr. Farim went on to show us that at times the female percentage of the population has dipped as low as 34% in each of those places. He even showed that the birth data portrays a significant difference in the number of female babies born versus male babies born each year for the past century. He even showed that the birth data portrays a significant difference in the number of female babies born versus male babies born each and every year for the past century. Whatever is causing this, nobody has an answer for it. Fortunately, for us anyway, Earth is extremely racially diverse and has many people moving into these areas to make up for the problem. However, we don't know if it could spread or not, as we don't know yet what is causing this. Jesus, Charles heard Alma whisper next to him. So, as you can imagine, the governments of Earth are extremely interested in what the cause of the problem here on Proxima B is. Not only are we here to save them, but potentially ourselves as well.
Intense, man.
Yeah, dude, head scientist from Skinwalker Ranch in a completely fictional tale. So no, he's got crazy ideas, though. I don't know where he would have got any of those ideas. Yeah, that's a novel. Who knows? That's a sci-fi. So that conversation, they said, was supposed to take place in 2100. So
cool. Can't wait. Yeah, lots to think about. Magnetic poles, all sorts of shit. Yeah, you got any final thoughts?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that should be it for us. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we will see you next week.
Thanks, guys.
That's it for this episode of Patterns Tell Stories. If you enjoy the show and want to help us keep it going, you can subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/patternstellstories. Subscribers get ad-free versions of the show each week, along with longer extended versions and additional Patreon premium episodes. Patrons also get full access to the article archive on our website and have the option of joining our Discord community. Separate from the website archive, you can find our individual blogs on Substack. Mine is at tinyklaus.com and Garrett's is at libertyburb.substack.com. You can follow us on X as well. My account is at tinyklaus and Garrett is at libertyburb. If you appreciate what we do, or even if you don't, please leave a review on the major podcast platforms like Apple and Spotify and let us know what you think. It also helps with the podcast algorithm, so hopefully our work can reach more people and we can continue to expand the conversation around the UFO topic. Thanks again so much for listening, and we'll see you all again soon.